Another blow landed, and Ewan winced. The Scarecrow's features were awash with dripping red. "Can you do the math? Can you, Arlen? Can you, you flesh-peddling bastard?" Ewan struggled to sit up, though his head pounded so hard that he groaned and blinked tears from his eyes. When he opened his mouth, nothing came out. He cleared his throat and found new agony, roaring pain that barreled down to his chest and back again. But he was able to produce a weak croak. "The Queen?" Javel paid no attention. He hit the Scarecrow again, this time in the throat, and the Scarecrow began to cough and gag. Now Ewan spotted his keys, still stuck in the lock of cell 3, dangerously close to the reach of Banneker. He crawled over and retrieved them, then approached Javel cautiously from behind.
"Stop!"
Ewan whispered. He couldn't seem to raise his voice. His throat felt as though someone had set it on fire.
"Stop! The Queen!"
Javel didn't stop, and Ewan realized then that Javel meant to hit the Scarecrow until he was dead. Ewan took a deep, painful breath and grabbed Javel beneath the arms, hauling him backward off the unconscious man. Javel snarled and turned on Ewan, attacking him with his fists. But Ewan accepted this with patience. The Queen would not wish Javel to be hurt either. Ewan certainly didn't want to hurt him. Javel had been a good and well-behaved prisoner, and even when Ewan had thrown him the keys, he had not fled. Ewan kept his arms around Javel in a bear hug, dragging him toward the wall, not letting go even when Javel hit Ewan in his right eye, snapping his head backward and sending sparks across his vision. He threw Javel up against the wall, hard enough for the man's head to rap against the stones. Javel groaned softly and rubbed his scalp, and Ewan took the moment of sudden silence to croak,
"The Queen wants this man alive. Do you hear? She wants him alive."
Javel looked at him with bleary eyes.
"The Queen. The Queen wants him alive. She told me so."
Javel smiled dreamily, and Ewan's stomach tightened with worry. Even after Dar's many lectures about minding his size, Ewan had injured one of his brothers while wrestling, rolling Peter into a fence post and breaking his shoulder. He might have thrown Javel against the wall too hard. Javel's voice, too, was odd, hazy, seeming to float somewhere over their heads.
"Queen Kelsey, I saw her, you know, on the keep lawn. But she was older. She looked like the true queen. I don't think anyone else saw." "What's the true queen?"
Ewan asked, unable to help himself. Whenever Dar told fairy stories, it was always the queens that Ewan liked best.
"The true queen. The one who saves us all."
A shrill cackle echoed behind them, and Ewan whirled, certain that the Scarecrow had only been shamming, that he somehow recovered his knife. But it was only the woman, Brenna, clutching the bars of her cage, grinning happily.
"The true queen,"
she mimicked in a ghastly, cracked voice.
"Fools. She goes to her death before the first snowfall. I've seen it."
Ewan blinked and then cast a quick glance toward the ground. The Scarecrow lay motionless, but Ewan was sure he had seen the man move. He turned back to Javel, who was still rubbing his head.
"Will you help me tie him up? I have rope."
"I can't kill him, can I?"
Javel asked sadly.
"Not even now."
"No,"
Ewan replied in a firm voice, certain of this one thing.
"The Queen wants him alive."
Isha trudged slowly down the hallway, a lit candle in one hand and the red leather-bound book in the other. 2 weeks ago she had turned 12, and Maman had given her permission to get up and read when she was wakeful. Maman didn't have insomnia, but she seemed to understand Isha's misery at being stuck there alone in the dark. She must have passed the request along to the Queen or the mace as well, because now the guards ignored Isha when they saw her wandering through the keep in her nightgown, clutching her book. She always went to the same place to read, the arms room. Venner and Fell were too important to work the night shift, so the room was always empty at night, save for the rare guard who came in to sharpen a sword or grab a replacement piece of armor. Isha liked to take the 5 straw men that Venna kept there for beginning sparring, arrange them in a big pile in the far corner, and curl up with her book. It was a good reading spot, quiet and private. She passed Corin, leaning against the wall. He was in charge of the night guard this week. Isha liked Corin. He always answered her questions, and he had shown her the best way to grip a knife for throwing. But she knew better than to talk to him when he was on duty. She gave him a small wave with 2 of the fingers holding her book, and saw him smile in return. None of the other guards lining the corridor were her friends, so she kept her eyes down until she reached the arms room. The cavernous chamber, large and dark, should have frightened her. Many dark rooms did. But Isha loved the glitter of weapons in the candlelight, the tables and tables of swords and knives and armor, the slight residual smell of old sweat. Even the long, looming shadows cast by her candle didn't frighten Isha. All of these shadows seemed to have the tall, careful aspect of Venna, and they were a comforting presence in the dark. Isha knew that she was becoming a better fighter every day. A few days ago, she'd even gotten through Fellsgard with her knife, while the men lining the walls hooted and cheered. Isha took it as a point of pride that several of the guards spent their free time watching her spar. She was getting better, yes, but that wasn't all. She sensed her own potential to be more than better, to be great.
Someday, I'll be one of the greatest fighters in the tier. I'll be the Fetch himself.
Isha had told no one about this dream, not even Mummel. Even if other people didn't laugh, she knew that to speak the dream out loud would curse it, hex it somehow. She gathered the straw men in the far corner of the arms room. And when they were arranged just right, she collapsed contentedly and opened her book to its mark. She read for hours through a great battle and the pleas of a woman who dreamed of holding a sword, and her mind raced ahead of her to the day when she would stride across the world, weapon in hand, finding evil and stabbing it out. These thoughts spun out before her, faster and faster, a grand dream. And finally, Isha slept. The candle continued to burn beside her for perhaps 40 minutes, until it guttered and died, leaving her in the dark. She awoke to the sound of the door opening, of voices. Her first instinct, learned from earliest childhood, was to freeze, to make herself invisible. She had escaped from Dar, but in waking moments, that never mattered. Some little part of her was always awake, waiting for his thick, ponderous movement in the dark. Slitting her eyes open, she saw a faint torchlight inching its way around the edge of the table. She drew her knees up, curling into the smallest ball possible. It was 2 men, she realized after a moment, one with a younger, lighter voice, and one with the older, roughened tones of a long-time Queen's Guard. This second voice took her only a few seconds to identify. The mace. Isha had heard his angry growl often enough lately to recognize it now, even when he spoke calmly and quietly. "Had a good break?" the mace asked. His tone was pleasant, but Isha heard unpleasantness just beneath it, lurking. The other man must have been able to hear it as well, because his voice, when he answered, was low and defensive.
"I'm sober. That's not my concern. I know you'll never make that mistake again."
"Then what's your concern?" the younger man asked, his tone aggressive.
"You and her."
Isha curled into a tighter ball, listening closely. This would be about Marguerite, for certain. All of the guards, even Corin, had a certain look on their faces when they watched Marguerite, even if she was just walking across a room. Isha had been jealous for a bit, but then she remembered that Corin was old, 38. Too old for Isha, even in her fantasy life. The mace's voice remained measured and careful, but there was still that tone lurking underneath.
"You can't hide much from me, you know. I've known you too long. You're not impartial." That's fine. Perhaps none of us are. But none of us have your job.
Leave off, the younger man snarled.
Don't take your anger out on me, the mace replied mildly. I haven't done this to you.
It's just difficult.
You've noticed the change in her, then?
I never cared which face she wore.
Ah, so this isn't new?
No.
That makes it worse, I think. Do you want me to choose another for your job?
No!
Isha's brow wrinkled. Something pulled at her memory. The identity of the younger guard was right there, almost identifiable. She thought about leaning around the corner of the table and taking a peek, but she didn't dare. The mace saw everything. He would certainly see the tip of her head if it poked out. He was sneaky himself, but he would not take kindly to an eavesdropper. And if she got caught, they might not let her come in here to read at night any more.
My skills aren't compromised, the younger guard insisted. It's a nuisance, not a problem.
The mace remained silent for a long moment, and when he spoke again, Isha was surprised to hear that his voice had softened.
You may think you're the first one this has ever happened to, but I assure you that this is an old problem for close guards. I understand it well, believe me. I'm not sure that it doesn't actually make you a better guard. You'd throw yourself in front of the knife without a thought, no?
Yes,
the younger man replied bleakly. And Isha finally identified him. Pen Olcott. She crouched lower, trying to remember the rest of the conversation, to puzzle it out.
What of that woman you found? The mace asked. Does she offer no relief at all?
Pen laughed, without humour.
10 minutes of relief, every time.
We can find another shield, you know.
The mace told him.
Several of them are ready. Elston would jump at the chance.
No. It would be a greater torment to be out of the room than in.
You say that now, but think, Pen. Think about when she takes a husband, or even just a man for the night. How will you feel then, being right outside the door?
She may not take either.
She will,
the mace replied firmly.
She has her mother's recklessness, and her mind grows older by the day. It won't be long before she finds that outlet.
Pen was silent for a long moment.
I don't want to be replaced. Partial or no, I'm the best man for the job, and you know it.
All right.
The mace's voice lost its gentle edge and became iron-hard as he continued.
But mark me, I'll be watching. And if I see one sign of impaired performance, you're done. Not just with your post, but with this guard. Do you understand?
Silence. The pile of straw men began to collapse behind Isha's back, and she dug her heels into the floor, clutching her book, trying to keep the entire mountain from shifting down in an avalanche.
I understand, Pen replied stiffly. I'm sorry to put you in this position.
Christ, Pen, we've all been there. You won't find a man in her mother's guard who didn't go through this at one point or another. It's an old problem. A difficult thing.
Isha was losing ground. She pushed hard with her legs, pressing back against the corner, holding the pile of strawmen in place. If they would only leave!
Better get about it now. She'll wake in a few hours.
Yes, sir.
Footsteps retreated toward the door.
Pen?
Sir?
You're doing a good job. She doesn't mind having you a foot away, I can tell. And that's really a remarkable accomplishment. I'm not sure she wouldn't have killed anyone else by now.
Pen didn't reply. A moment later, Isha heard the door open and close. She relaxed and felt one of the straw men topple to the ground on her right.
And you, Hellcat?
Isha gave a small shriek. The mace loomed over her, his hands clenched on the table edge. Despite her fright, Isha couldn't help staring at those hands, which were covered in scars. Venna and Fel had told her that the mace was a great fighter, one of the greatest in the tier. To have hands like that, he must have been battling for a lifetime. That's what I want to be, Isha realized, staring fixedly at the three white scars across one knuckle. That dangerous. That feared.
I've heard of your nightly wanderings, girl. Venna and Fel tell me you've a great gift for the knife.
Isha nodded, her face flushing slightly with pleasure.
Do you come here every night?
Almost. I wish I could sleep in here. The mace was not distracted.
You've heard something you shouldn't. Something that could be very dangerous to the Queen.
Why?
Don't play foolish with me. I've watched you. You're a quick little thing.
Isha paused for a moment. I am quick. But I won't tell anyone what I heard.
You're not an easy child.
The mace looked closely at her, and Isha shrank back. His eyes were terrible things, invasive, as though he were turning her inside out with his gaze.
What do you mean to do with your knife one day, if you're as gifted as Venna and Fel claim?
I'll be a queen's guard, Isha replied promptly. She had decided this 3 days ago at the very moment she had snuck under Fel's guard and dimpled his jugular with her knife.
Why?
Isha cast around for words, but nothing came. Only the image, deep in her mind, of Dar's shadow on the nighttime wall. That was nothing she could tell the mace about, even if she could explain Dar to anyone. There were huge swaths of memory gone. Dark patches where Isha's early childhood had simply disappeared. It would be an impossible tale to tell. But this place, the Queen's Wing, was safe. A well-lit shelter where they could stay forever. Mammal said they were in constant danger here, but Isha could live with the danger of swords. She understood that it was Mammal, Mammal's queerness that had somehow gotten them in here in the first place. But the Queen existed above Mammal, a godlike figure dressed in black, and Isha knew that she would never again have to see Dar's shadow on the wall. She couldn't tell any of this to the mace. All she could say was, I'd never do anything to hurt the Queen. I'd kill anyone who tried. The mace's arrow-like gaze pierced her for a moment longer, seeming to knife through her body. Then he nodded.
I'm going to trust you, Hellcat. More than that, I'm going to consider this your first test. Swordsmanship is an important quality for a Queen's Guard. But there are other things just as crucial. And one of them is your ability to keep a secret.
I can keep a secret, sir. Probably better than most adults. The mace nodded, pity in his gaze. And Isha realized then that he must know all about Dar. Maman sat right next to the Queen every day, brought her food and drink. They would have found out everything about her. And Dar had been no secret in their neighborhood. Even when Isha was little, no other children had ever been allowed over to their house to play. Captain?
What?
Even if I keep quiet, other people might find out. They might see it in Penn's face like you did.
Did you?
No, but I'm 12.
It's a fair point, the mace replied seriously. But let's just say that I see more in men's faces than most. I think the secret will be safe for a while, just between you and me.
Yes, sir.
Off to bed, Hellcat.
Isha scrambled up, grabbed her book and candle, and left. In their family room, she placed the red leather book carefully on her bedside table and climbed into bed. But she couldn't sleep yet. Her thoughts were too full of all she'd seen and heard. Penn Olcott was in love with the Queen. But the Queen couldn't marry one of her guard, even Isha knew that, though she could not have said why. So Penn had no hope at all. She tried to feel some sympathy for him, but could only muster up a little. Penn got to stand right next to the Queen every day, his sword protecting her from the wide world. Surely that was reward enough. Love was a real thing, Isha thought, but secondary. Certainly, love was not as real as her sword.
Chapter 7 The Gallery.
The Mort do nothing halfway. Anon. Tree.
Tyler held up another slip of paper.
The mace looked at it for a moment, wearing the same irritated, truculent expression that he always wore during these sessions.
Bread.
Tyler held up another slip, holding his breath.
After some dithering, he had decided to throw some difficult words into this batch, for this particular student would not want to be coddled.
The mace stared at the word for a moment, his eyes flickering back and forth between syllables. Tyler had encouraged him to sound out the words, but the mace refused to do so. He wanted to do everything inside his head. His reading level progressed at a pace that was nearly alarming.
Difference,
the mace finally declared.
Good.
Tyler put the cards down.
That's very good.
The mace wiped his brow. He'd been sweating.
I'm still having trouble between C and K.
It's difficult, Tyler agreed, not meeting the mace's eyes.
Tyler walked a fine line in these sessions, tiptoeing between being encouraging and being solicitous. For if the mace felt that Tyler was treating him as a child, he would likely beat Tyler senseless. But still, Tyler found himself looking forward to these lessons. He enjoyed teaching, and was sorry that he'd waited until his 71st year to discover that fact. But this was the only enjoyable part of Tyler's days. His leg, which had fractured at the shin, was wrapped in a cast, a constant reminder of the Holy Father's anger. The entire Avath seemed to know that Tyler was in trouble, and his brother priests had shunned him accordingly. Only Wide, who was too old to be concerned about his place on the Avath ladder, seemed willing to be seen in Tyler's company.
The mace was looking at him expectantly, waiting for more instructions. But Tyler had suddenly lost his enthusiasm for the lesson.
He stacked the cards on his desk and looked curiously at the mace.
How did you get away with it all of these years?
The mace's expression tightened, became wary.
What does it matter?
It doesn't. I'm only curious. I could certainly never have pulled it off.
The mace shrugged. He was immune to flattery.
Carol knew. He wanted my skills in the guard, so he helped me to keep it a secret. We had an agreement.
Why didn't he teach you?
He offered.
The mace looked away.
I refused. It didn't matter then anyway. Alyssa had about as much use for books as a cat has for a riding crop. But now...
Tyler heard the mace's unspoken thought easily. Queen Alyssa may not have cared about illiteracy, but Queen Kelsey would care very much.
But the Queen would never kick you out of the guard.
Of course she wouldn't. I just don't want her to know.
Tyler nodded, wondering, as he so often did, whether the mace was the Queen's father. His attitude toward her was often that of an exasperated parent. But the identity of the Queen's father was one of the most closely held secrets of the guard. Tyler wasn't even sure whether the Queen knew herself.
What's next?
Tyler thought for a moment.
Practice stringing individual words together. In the Queen's library are several books by a man named Dahl. Choose one, and try to work your way through it. Don't skip the longer words. Sound them out, and bring the book with you the next time you come.
The mace nodded.
I think...
Three sharp raps sounded on Tyler's door. The mace sprung from his chair, a quick silent movement. When Tyler turned to look behind him, the room was empty, the hidden door beside the desk just swinging shut.
Come in, please.
The door opened, and Tyler froze as the Holy Father entered the room. Brother Jennings was behind him, his round face curious, but the Holy Father left him outside, closing the door. Tyler grasped the edge of the desk and pulled himself to his feet, keeping his broken leg off the floor.
Good day, Tyler.
Your Holiness?
Tyler offered him the good chair, but Anders waved it away.
Sit, Tyler, sit. You, after all, are the one with the broken leg. Most unfortunate, that accident.
Tyler sat, watching Anders' eyes dart all over the room, taking in everything, while his face remained immobile. In that way, he did remind Tyler of the old Holy Father, who never missed a single thing. All of Tyler's earlier feelings of bravery seemed to have evaporated quickly and quietly, and he was acutely aware of his own old age. How fragile he was in comparison to this hearty, middle-aged man.
I am in a difficult position, Tyler.
The Holy Father gave a heavy, melodramatic sigh.
The Queen. She has laid hands on me, you see.
Tyler nodded. No one was supposed to touch a priest of God's church, not publicly anyway. And it was unthinkable for anyone, let alone a woman, to lay hands on the Holy Father himself. It had only been a week, but Wide, who worked at the homeless kitchens in the morning, said that the entire city already seemed to know what had happened at the Queen's dinner. Wide had even heard one rumour that the Queen had given the Holy Father a savage beating with her bare hands. These stories were harmful to the Queen, certainly. The devout were scandalized. But the damage to the Holy Father was much greater.
This won't stand, Tyler. If no consequences fall on the Queen for her actions, then we are all left hanging in the wind. The Arvath's political power will dwindle to nothing. You understand?
Tyler nodded again.
But if God's wrath were to fall on her swiftly, think of it, Tyler.
The Holy Father's eyes brightened, sparkling with a hint of that same terrible glee that Tyler had seen there on the night of Father Seth.
Think of how God's church would benefit. Conversions would increase. Tithing would increase. Faith has grown slack, Tyler, and we need to make an example. A public example. You see?
Tyler didn't see. Not exactly. But he didn't like the turn of the conversation. Anders had halted in his pacing now, right in front of Tyler's bookshelves. He pulled down a distant mirror, and Tyler tensed, lacing his fingers together at his waist. When Anders opened the book and ran a finger down one of the middle pages, Tyler's flesh crawled beneath his skin.
The Queen is not vulnerable, he blurted out. There is the mace, and she has magic.
Magic.
In a sudden sharp movement, Anders wrenched the book down the binding, tearing it in two. Tyler cried out, his hands reaching automatically before he snatched them back. He did not have the Queen's gall. He could not lay hands on the Holy Father. He could only watch as Anders dropped one shredded half of the book and began to rip pages out of the other, one at a time. They drifted lazily back and forth toward the floor.
Magic, Tyler?
Anders asked softly.
And you a priest?
A soft knock came at the door, and Brother Jennings leaned through the doorway, his avid eyes taking in the entire scene.
Everything all right, Your Holiness?
Perfectly so,
Anders replied, his gaze fixed on Tyler.
Fetch a few more brothers in here. There's work to do.
Brother Jennings nodded and left. Tyler stared mutely at the books on his shelves. There were so many of them.
Please, he heard himself beg. Please, don't. They never did you any harm.
These are secular books, Tyler, and you've been storing them in the Arvath. I'd be well within my rights to burn them.
They don't hurt anyone. I'm the only one who reads them.
Brother Jennings knocked and entered. Several other priests followed, including Wide, who gave Tyler an apprehensive glance as he came through the door. Anders pointed to the shelves.
Remove the books and their holders to my private apartments.
The younger priests began to move immediately, but Wide hesitated, staring at Tyler.
"Problem, Father Wide?"
Anders asked. Wide shook his head and held out his arms to accept a pile of books from the shelf. He didn't look at Tyler again. While they worked, Anders continued to rip the pages from a distant mirror. One landed at Tyler's feet, and when he looked down, he saw Chapter 7 in bold print. Tears filled his eyes, and he had to bite his lip to keep them there. Looking up, he made the unpleasant discovery that Anders was enjoying himself enormously, his eyes sparkling with pleasure. The priests continued to march in and out of the room until finally the shelves stood empty against the wall. The sight made Tyler want to break down and weep. Brother Jennings levered the bookshelves from the wall and tipped them horizontal, and Wide snuck Tyler one last apologetic glance as he grabbed hold of a corner. Then they were gone. The wall was blank. Only two whitened rectangles remained to show where Tyler's books had been. He stared numbly at them, and now the tears came, beyond his power to hold back.
"Tyler."
Tyler turned, his heart pounding, to face the Holy Father. For the first time in his adult life, he wanted to do violence to another person. His hands had clenched into fists inside the sleeves of his robe. Anders reached inside his own robes and came out with a small vial of clear, colourless liquid. He passed it thoughtfully from one hand to another before remarking,
"The Queen is not protective of her person with you. I watched you pass her the bread at dinner. Does her drink ever pass through your hands?"
Tyler nodded jerkily. His face had gone cold.
"Tea."
"The Mace can't consider you a threat, or he would never tolerate such an arrangement."
The Holy Father held out the vial. It looked smooth in his hand, almost oily, and Tyler stared numbly, unable to accept.
"I won't insult your intelligence, Tyler, by explaining what you're to do with this. But I want it done within a month. If not, you will watch me douse every single one of your books in oil and strike a match. I will do it personally, on the front steps of the Arvath, and you will watch."
Tyler cast around for answers, but there was nothing, only the pile of torn pages on the ground.
"Take it, Tyler."
He took the vial.
"Come with me,"
the Holy Father commanded, opening the door. Tyler grabbed his crutches and lurched forward to follow. Several brothers and fathers had their doors open, and they stared at Tyler as he went by, following the Holy Father down the hallway toward the staircase. Tyler sensed them, but didn't see them, his mind utterly blank now. It seemed important not to think of his books, and that meant not thinking of anything at all. At the end of the corridor, they emerged onto the staircase landing. Tyler tried to keep his eyes on the ground, but at the last moment he couldn't help looking up. Seth was there, sitting on his stool as he had done every day for the past 2 weeks, his legs spread wide to display the mangled area between them. The actual wound had been cauterized and stitched up somehow, but what remained was almost worse, a charred and seamed landscape of red flesh. Pink streaks radiated outward along Seth's inner thighs, signifying the beginning of infection. Hung around his neck was a placard with one scrawled word:
"Abomination."
Seth stared blankly down the hallway, his gaze so fixed that Tyler wondered if they were keeping him dulled with some sort of narcotic.
But no. What killed pain would also kill the point of the lesson, wouldn't it?
For the first week, Seth's moans of agony had been audible all the way down the hall, and none of them had slept for days. Tyler closed his eyes, and then, mercifully, they were past Seth and down the stairs. Anders began to speak again, his voice pitched low enough to reach Tyler, but not Brother Jennings, who trailed silently several feet behind.
"I am not unaware, Tyler, that this must be an unpleasant errand for you.
and every unpleasant errand requires not only punishment for failure, but reward for success.
Tyler followed mutely, still trying to push Seth's image from his mind. The Holy Father's talk of reward did not cheer him in the slightest. In his childhood, Tyler had seen village dogs trained in much the same way for the ring. When an animal was beaten hard enough, it would work just not to be beaten, and consider itself well rewarded. The status quo could shift at any time.
My books.
The numbness broke slightly, and Tyler felt agony there, waiting, like freezing water beneath thin ice. He focused on walking, feeling each step as an individual ache. The old Holy Father had always used the lift to transport him between floors, but Anders rarely did so. He seemed to enjoy demonstrating his own fitness, and now he was surely enjoying Tyler's discomfort as well. The arthritis had woken up, causing Tyler's hip to throb unhappily. His broken leg snarled with each step, even though Tyler was careful never to let it bump against the ground. He concentrated on each of these discomforts, almost relishing them, easy pains that were entirely physical. After endless flights of stairs, they passed the ground floor and continued down the steps into the Arvath's basement. Tyler had never been to the basement, which was only a resting place for Holy Father's deceased. No one came down here, except for two unfortunate brothers who had drawn the duty to keep the crypts free of insects and rats. These two, men unfamiliar to Tyler, sprang to their feet and bowed as the Holy Father entered, Tyler following at his heels like a ghost. Anders took the torch that one of the young men offered and led Tyler into the tombs. It was bone cold down here, and Tyler shivered in his thin robes. They passed the entrances to many crypts, decorated arches of stone that stretched high above them on both sides. The corpses of Holy Fathers were always embalmed before being laid to rest, but Tyler still thought that he could smell death in this place. Briefly, he wondered if Anders had brought him down here to kill him, and then he discarded that idea. He was needed. God, please show me the way out. The crypts were behind them now. Ahead was only a single large stone door covered with a layer of dust. As they drew up in front of it, Anders produced a simple iron key.
Look at me, Tyler.
Tyler looked up, but found that he couldn't meet the other man's eyes. Instead, he fixed his gaze on the bridge of Anders' nose.
I am the only person with a key to this door, Tyler. But if you succeed in your task, I will give this key to you.
He opened the door, though it required several twists of the key to do so. The door squealed miserably as the Holy Father shoved it open. No one had entered this room in a long time. The Holy Father beckoned him inside, but Tyler already knew somehow what would be there. And as light from the torch fell over the room, despair wrapped around Tyler's heart. The room was full of books. Someone had constructed shelves for them, the sort of rough-hewn furniture that had predominated after the landing, when even simple tools were difficult to come by. Tyler's eyes roamed helplessly across the room, shelf after shelf of books, thousands of them, all the way down to the far wall. He stepped forward, drawn helplessly, reaching out to touch the books on their shelves. Some were leather-bound, some paper. No one had cared for them, or even bothered to organize them. Titles and authors had been thrown together haphazardly, stacked horizontally on the shelves. Everything was covered with a thick layer of dust. The sight hurt Tyler's heart.
Tyler!
He started for a moment. He'd forgotten that the Holy Father was there.
If you succeed, the Holy Father said softly, not only will you have the key to this room, but you will become the Arvath's first librarian. You will cease to be the keep priest, and I will relieve you of all other duties.
No one will ever bother you again. Your only task will be to live down here and take care of these books.
Tyler turned back to stare at the room, breathing in the smell of old paper. He could spend the rest of his life in here and not read the same book twice.
The poison is delayed, the Holy Father continued. It will take some 2 or 3 hours for the Queen to show the first symptoms. This is your window to return to the Arvath.
They'll come after me.
The mace will. Perhaps. But not even the mace will dare to remove you from the Arvath without my permission. You saw how they had to lure Matthew to the keep in order to take him. You may never be able to leave the Arvath again, but so long as you make it back, you will be safe from reprisal, and you may live your life out here, with these books.
Thinking of the mace's uncanny ability to appear and disappear from walls at will, Tyler almost smiled. The mace would find him, no matter where he went, but Tyler didn't bother to correct the Holy Father. He wondered what the Queen would say if she could see this room.
"What happens after she dies?" he asked, startling himself.
"There will be a bit of squabbling, certainly. But eventually the tear will become a mort protectorate."
Tyler blinked.
"The Red Queen is a noted unbeliever. Will that not be worse for the Church?"
"No."
A smile played at the corners of Anders' mouth.
"Everything has already been arranged."
"Poor bedfellows," Tyler thought sickly, recalling the mace's words.
"My leg is still weak, Your Holiness. I would like to go back upstairs."
"Of course," Anders replied, his tone solicitous now. "We will go at once."
Anders locked the door behind them, and they moved slowly back between the tombs. Tyler's leg had gotten so bad that he was now forced to hobble.
"We will take the lift, Tyler, to spare your leg."
Together they crowded onto the thick platform of wood that stood beside the staircase, and Anders nodded to the two priests who waited there.
"Brothers' quarters."
Tyler grabbed the railing, slightly sick again, as the lift began to rise.
"This is a test, Tyler," the Holy Father told him. "God is testing your faith, your loyalty."
Tyler nodded, but he felt lost and bewildered. He had lived in the Arvath for his entire adult life, considered it home. But now it seemed a strange landscape, pitted with unknown dangers. When the lift reached the quarters, he wandered away from the Holy Father without a word, past Seth, and down the hallway, past the staring eyes of his brothers, past Wide, who waited beside Tyler's doorway, his eyes downcast.
"I'm sorry," Wide murmured. "I didn't want to, Tyler, but..."
Tyler closed the door in his face and went to sit on the bed. The bare walls seemed to glare at him, and he tried to ignore them, tried to pray. But he couldn't escape the feeling that no one was listening, that God's attention was elsewhere. Finally, he gave up and pulled the small vial out of his robes, rolling it in both hands, running one thumb over the waxed stopper. The liquid inside was perfectly clear. Tyler could look straight through and see a distorted image of the tiny room around him, the room where not so long ago he had expected to live contentedly for the rest of his life. He thought of the Queen's library, the way time seemed to disappear as Tyler sat there, everything melting away until he felt that he was part of some better world.
He could not do this thing, but he could not leave his books either.
There seemed no way out. Tyler got up and placed his hand on the wall, smoothing a palm across the white stone. There was no help for him in prayer, he saw now. Nor could he afford to wait for miracles.
God would not single Tyler out.
If he wanted salvation, he would have to save himself.
"This is a fool's errand," Mace grumbled.
"You think all of my errands are foolish, Lazarus?
I'm not impressed. They were travelling in near darkness through one of the mace's many tunnels that seemed to beehive the keep. The only illumination came from a torch carried by Father Tyler, who limped alongside Penn. In the dim amber light, the priest's face looked paler than ever. Kelsey had asked Mace what was going on in the Arvath to make Father Tyler so miserable, but Mace, being Mace, had refused to say, remarking only that the new Holy Father was even worse than the old. It was Father Tyler who had sent Kelsey on this little jaunt. The vision of William Tyr had sent her into a kind of frenzy, and in the past week she had torn Carlin's library apart, determined to find some information about Lily Mayhew, about Greg Mayhew, about Dorian Rice, about any of them. When Father Tyler had arrived this morning, Kelsey had been sitting there on the library floor, in a rut of sleeplessness and failure, surrounded by Carlin's books, and she seized on the priest as a last resort. Were there any written histories about the years surrounding the crossing, the life of William Tyr? There had been no actual publishing after the crossing, of course, but perhaps there was a handwritten history. Someone should have kept a journal, at least. Father Tyler shook his head regretfully. Many of the original generation of Utopians had indeed kept journals, but in the dark period after the Tyr assassination, most of them had disappeared. Several fragments had been preserved in the Arvath, and Father Tyler had seen them. But they discussed everyday problems of survival, the scarcity of food, the labour of constructing the fledgling village that would one day become New London. Most of Father Tyler's own knowledge of the crossing was based on oral history, the same folklore that pervaded the rest of the Tierling. No real writings had survived. But there is something, Majesty, Tyler remarked after a moment's thought. Father Timpany used to tell stories about a portrait gallery somewhere in the lower floors of the keep. The regent would visit the gallery from time to time, and Timpany said there's a portrait of William Tyr down there. Why on earth would my uncle visit a portrait gallery? It's a gallery of your ancestors, Majesty. Timpany said that when the regent was drunk, he liked to go down and scream at your grandmother's portrait. It turned out that Mace knew exactly where the gallery was, two floors down on the laundry level. As they descended a twisting staircase, Kelsey could hear many people speaking through the walls. Although she had her own private laundry, Mace, who worried about contact poisons, had insisted on it, Kelsey had kept the keep laundry open, sending the rest of the Queen's Wings linen down there. Her uncle's keep had been stuffed with unnecessary services, but Kelsey couldn't bring herself to put so many people out of work. She had fired the worst of the keep servants, the masseuses and escorts, those she simply wouldn't have on her payroll, but she tried to make use of everyone else. At the bottom of the staircase, she could see no farther than the tiny, dim circle of torchlight that surrounded them. But she had the sense of a vast hollow space above her head. Who built all these tunnels?
They're part of the original architecture, lady. There are hidden ways all the way from the top of the keep down to the dungeons. Several passages extend out into the city as well.
Mention of dungeons made Kelsey think of Thorn, who now sat in his own specially constructed cell several floors up. Kelsey didn't trust him in the keep's dungeons, not even with Elston standing guard over him at all times. She also had a vague idea that Thorn should remain separated from the albino Brenner. So he remained in isolation, save for a gloating Elston just outside the bars of his cell. Kelsey didn't know what to do about Thorn. Should she put him to trial? For the past 6 weeks, Kelsey and Arliss had been quietly converting the Census Bureau into a tax collection agency. But they'd also been pulling the honest men from the Bureau and moving them back into the judiciary. Creation of a justice system was slow going. The Tierling had few laws, and none of them were codified anywhere. Since the Mort had reached the border, Kelsey had found little time to devote to this endeavour, but at her request, Arliss had kept at it, and now New London had 5 public courts where anyone could petition a judge for redress of grievances. The Crown could try Arlan Fawn in a public court, but what if he was acquitted? Judge or jury, either one could be bought. Conversely, even if Thorne's guilt was not beyond question, many jurors would condemn him, regardless of the evidence. After the regent, Thorne was the most hated figure in the tier. There was no real purpose to a trial, and yet Kelsey felt there should be one, all the same. Mace wanted to simply put Thorne to death. The man was so universally hated that no one would protest a quick execution, particularly not if Kelsey made the execution public. She saw the wisdom of Mace's advice. Such a move would gain her throne the die-hard support of anyone who had ever watched a loved one put into the cage. Even the Arvath didn't protest against capital punishment these days, and Kelsey certainly had no problem with it. Yet something in her demanded a trial, even a show trial, something to legitimize the act. But there was legal precedent for summary executions. If Father Tyler's folklore was to be believed, William Tyr had practiced them, had even carried one out with his own hands. "And so have I," Kelsey thought, suddenly cold. In her mind she saw blood, thick and warm, spurting over her right hand and dripping down her forearm. The outside world assumed that Mern had simply been a casualty of the Battle of the Argive. Mace had allowed that belief to flourish. But Kelsey and the rest of her guard knew better, and no matter how she tried to dismiss the matter from her mind, the image kept recurring to her, her knife hand bathed in blood. It seemed so important for Thorne to have a trial.
"Cover your eyes, lady."
Kelsey shielded her eyes as daylight bloomed in the darkness ahead. She passed through one of Mace's hidden doors and found herself in a long, narrow room with a high ceiling. The light came from a bank of windows on the far wall. Looking out these windows, Kelsey saw that they were at the extreme western end of the keep. Outside, she saw first the rolling foothills of the city, and then the tan backdrop of the Clayton Mountains.
"Here, Majesty," Father Tyler announced from the far end of the hallway.
Kelsey turned and found that the wall they'd just come through was lined with portraits. They ran the length of the gallery in both directions. Father Tyler had gone to the father's portrait and rested a hand on the base of the frame where there was an engraved wooden plaque. The portrait showed the same man Kelsey had seen in her vision. A tall, severe man with short-cropped blonde hair, his face set in businesslike lines. Kelsey's heart leapt. She had known that her visions were real, of course, but it was still an enormous relief to have empirical proof.
"William Tyr," Father Tyler announced, placing his torch in the empty bracket on the wall.
The sunlight was so bright in here that there was no need of fire.
"The plaque says this was painted 5 years after the crossing."
Kelsey moved closer, staring up at the first Tyr king. He stood in front of a fireplace, but not the sort of grand fireplace that littered the keep, more like that of the cottage where she had grown up. Even the artist had not been able to disguise Tyr's annoyance at having to simply stand still. His expression betrayed extreme impatience. The portrait must have been someone else's idea. Dimly in the background, Kelsey glimpsed a shelf full of books, but a thick layer of grime had accumulated on the surface of the portrait, and she couldn't make out any titles. "I want a keep servant to clean these," she told Mace. "Surely they have plenty of time on their hands." Mace nodded, and Kelsey moved on to the next portrait, a young blonde man barely out of his teens. He was good-looking, but even through layers of dust, Kelsey could see the worry that shrouded his eyes. She ran her fingers over the frame, looking for a plaque, and found it, coated with dust as well. She polished it with her thumb, wiping her dirty hand on her skirt, and bent down to read the engraving.
"Jonathan Tyr."
"Jonathan the Good," Father Tyler murmured beside her.
On Jonathan Tyr's chest, Kelsey spotted a sapphire, one of hers, dangling on its chain. She looked quickly back to the portrait of William Tyr. He wasn't wearing any jewellery, at least not that Kelsey could see. There was a sizable space between the two portraits, William and Jonathan, wide enough that Kelsey wondered if another portrait had once hung there. Who was Jonathan Tyr's mother? Father Tyler shook his head.
That I don't know, Majesty. William Tyr had no queen. Legend says he didn't believe in marriage. But there's no record of any doubt that Jonathan the Good was his son. The resemblance is marked.
What was Jonathan so worried about, do you think?
Perhaps he feared death, lady, Corin replied behind her. He was 20 years old when he was murdered. That portrait couldn't have been done more than a couple of years before.
Who murdered him?
No one knows. But they got through Tyr's guard. The worst moment in our history, that.
Corin broke off suddenly, and she knew that he was thinking of Myrne. Barty had said the same thing about the Tyr assassination. The guard had failed. Regretting Corin's discomfort, Kelsey swallowed the rest of her questions about Jonathan Tyr and passed onward to the next portrait. A woman, very innocent-looking, with a beautiful head of reddish-brown hair that ran over her shoulders like a river, dropping in long streamers down her back. She smiled beatifically from the canvas. Kelsey checked the engraved plaque.
Caitlin Tyr,
Jonathan Tyr's wife.
After the assassination, Caitlin Tyr had been hunted down and slaughtered. Although the woman in the portrait was long dead, beyond any harm, Kelsey's heart wrenched. This woman looked as though she couldn't even conceive of evil, much less endure it.
The next portrait made Kelsey suck in her breath. She would have known this man anywhere. He had stood in front of her fireplace 2 weeks earlier, the handsomest man in the world. He sat on the Tyr throne. The elaborately carved back was unmistakable, smiling an easy politician's smile. But his amber eyes were cold, and by an odd artist's trick they seemed to follow Kelsey no matter where she moved. Gingerly, she felt along the edges of the frame, but there was nothing, only an odd scarring of the wood that suggested that the plaque, if one existed, had been torn away long ago. She wondered at the handsome man's presence in this gallery of Tyr royalty, but said nothing.
"Handsome devil," Mace remarked. "No idea who he is, though. Father?"
Father Tyler shook his head.
"He doesn't match any Raleigh monarch I've ever heard of. He is exceptionally good-looking, though. Perhaps it was a companion to one of the Raleigh queens. Several of them never married, but all of them managed to produce heirs. They had an eye for the handsome men."
Kelsey picked that unfortunate moment to look at Penn, and found his eyes on her as well. The night he had rejected her sat between them like a vast gulf, and Kelsey had a terrible feeling that they would never get back to the easy friendship they'd had before. She wanted to say something to him, but there were too many people nearby, and after a moment, even the impulse at reconciliation vanished. The eyes of the man from the fireplace were hypnotic, but Kelsey dragged herself away and moved on to the next portrait. They were into the Raleighs now. All of these portraits had their plaques intact, and the engravings became clearer, less worn by the passage of time, as Kelsey moved closer to the present day. All of the Raleighs wore both sapphires, the jewels appearing chainless from one portrait to the next. These were Kelsey's ancestors, her blood. But she found them somehow less important than the three Tyrs, less real. Carlin had never admired the Raleighs. Perhaps her prejudices in this, as in so many things, had simply trickled down to Kelsey over the years. In the 10th portrait, Kelsey was confronted with a woman so beautiful that she almost defied description. She had the same blonde hair and bright green eyes as many of the Raleigh queens, but her face was creamy-skinned and flawless, and she had the most gracefully proportioned neck that Kelsey had ever seen on a woman. Unlike the previous portraits, which had focused on one person at a time, this one also portrayed a child, a pretty girl of nearly 6 years, who sat on her mother's lap.